We're going to start our history of amusement parks and specifically of Disney next week with Robert and I. But I recently published a book and I wanted to explore with Robert some of the deeper topics of the book, which include discussions of several U.S., early U.S. presidents. So here's a bonus special edition of the Florida History Podcast. Welcome back to the Florida History Podcast. I'm Carter Krishnire.
And I'm Robert Bucciolato.
Robert, I have just published a book about the American conquest of Florida. In fact, it's called The American Conquest of Florida, which brings us into topics of the U.S. presidency for the first time in my writings. You've written a book about the presidents directly related to Florida. I have not until this point. And so who better than you to have this conversation with me? We're going to cover the administrations of Jefferson. The book covers the administrations of Jefferson, Madison, and Monroe, and of course features two future presidents in John Quincy Adams and Jackson and their interactions with what I call the American conquest of Florida. Robert, start with the Jefferson administration and fire away. I'd love to answer any questions you have about Jefferson and Florida.
Well, my friend, the first thing I want to point out is that there are many people that are probably better than me that you could have this conversation with as far as the presidency is concerned, but I was the one that was available.
You're way too modest. So,
but you know, because you and me, we've been recording these for, you know, we've got 5 years now.
Yep.
And before we start recording, what people don't know is that we basically catch up and we kind of go through what we're going to talk about. But pretty quickly, it sort of just turns into like a full-on just, you know, history fest where we're just kind of debating and asking questions about stuff, and more, especially since you've been writing these books, we've been talking about the first four presidents. Now, one of the things, and the thing that is, I think, has always scratched historians, and I'd love to get your take on it, is what was the turnaround? How did this happen where you had somebody like Thomas Jefferson and by extension James Madison that were just totally against the whole concept of an executive that had such far-reaching powers? You were against he was against the notion of a centralized, strong national government. And then he turns around and he starts buying up things. He starts changing the landscape of the country. He becomes very expansive, and his hunger for land seemed to grow with the eating. He tried to pick up everything he could and begin making inroads in Florida and trying to eventually purchase Florida, which his successors did do. What do you think was this turnaround for him, why he became so ambitious as far as colonizing the continent?
I think for Jefferson, I think one of the things we're probably going to talk about in this podcast, and I talk a lot about in the book, is the inconsistencies of Madison, just kind of Madison's philosophy in terms of being the father of the Constitution versus Madison, the president. With Jefferson, I think that there was a desire to acquire New Orleans and West Florida. I don't think the rest of Louisiana was even on his mind, quite honestly, the rest of the Louisiana territory. They wanted to acquire West Florida because it made sense geographically from an eastern seaboard standpoint. And I think there was a feeling that you had a lot of American settlers already moving into places like Amelia Island, Fernandina Beach, right immediately over the border. And then West Florida, you had almost completely was dominated by places like the Natchez Trace, which is now in Mississippi. Mobile was a port that I think the U.S. felt they needed to get their hands on. Those places were places that had a lot of American settlers and plantations were beginning to develop. Mobile was an important port. And then I would say, I don't know if Jefferson quite saw this, but certainly Madison and Monroe did. The Apalachicola River ended up being critical to getting, it was like a highway that you would use to get up into Georgia and Alabama via the Flint River and the Chattahoochee River, right? The river system that we're all familiar with. And you needed to acquire the Apalachicola River. That's, I think this is Jefferson. When it comes to Madison and Monroe later, I think they're trying to extend slaveholding to areas, if I'm being quite frank with you. And I know there's this historical narrative now out there, particularly on the left. I don't want to get too deep into this, but on the left, Jefferson was really a bad guy and all about slavery. I don't think Jefferson thought as much about slavery when he was thinking of expansion the way Madison and Monroe and then future U.S. presidents did, who were Southerners. I do think by the time we get to the U.S. acquiring, finally acquiring Florida, it was about extending slavery. I get into that in the book, but I don't think it was as much for Jefferson. And I also think, Robert, this is something that we can again distinguish Jefferson from those who succeeded him. I don't think Jefferson ever wanted to use force to seize Florida. When the Louisiana Purchase took place and he and his administration, of which Madison was the Secretary of State, right, were convinced that West Florida, at the very least, not all of Florida, but West Florida, which was the portion that at the time ran from the Apalachicola River to Baton Rouge, right, to the Mississippi, they thought West Florida, because it had been in much of it had been in French hands prior to 1763, it had been in Spanish hands concurrently with Louisiana up until 1800, from 1783 to 1800, that it was part of the purchase. Now, the part that they conveniently ignored was that West Florida, as we've talked about a lot on this podcast, was in British hands for a critical 18-year period from 1763 to 1781. And because at that point it was detached from Louisiana and the British governed it in coordination with East Florida, which was a British colony, governed from St. Augustine, and this area was then called West Florida, right? It may have been governed as part of Louisiana when the French, before the French lost the French and Indian War. But after that, the British took it and they governed it separately. It had been detached from Louisiana. So Jefferson is trying to get Talleyrand and Napoleon's emissaries to say, hey, this is part of the Louisiana Purchase. This is a French area. He's resorting to diplomacy to do that. He's resorting to the Congress. The Congress was obsessed with West Florida also. Congress, after Jefferson was reelected in 1804, is making this a priority. But I don't think Robert Jefferson ever wanted to use force. So in that sense, he was consistent. We know Jefferson is a president that very reluctantly, he didn't want a standing army. He didn't want, he decommissioned the U.S. Navy, which, by the way, ended up costing the U.S. dearly in the War of 1812. And I would also say he was very, very reluctant to appear to be provoking some sort of international conflict, particularly when it came to France. This having been said, right, you make the point that he was someone who was not for expansion. He was someone who in general was against these sorts of conflicts. I mean, the thing that haunted Jefferson throughout his career was that when Benedict Arnold and Simcoe the Queen's Rangers had invaded Virginia in 1781 on behalf of the British military. Jefferson cut and run, right? Right? He didn't fight. He didn't stay in Williamsburg and then stay in Richmond and fight. He headed out into the country. He was naturally not someone inclined to war. He was someone inclined to the pen. Yet the expansion is kind of contradictory with him. But I found from doing the research for this book, and I should say a lot of the research came from reading Henry Adams and reading Gary Will's interpretations of Henry Adams, and Gary Will's own writing about Jefferson and Madison, that I don't have as much of a distaste for how Jefferson conducted himself as I do with Adams. I really left the research, and we'll get into it in a minute. I'll let you jump in, but I really left the research and writing of the book with a very, very dim view of Adams' presidency. I still admire Adams, the framer of the Constitution and the founder of the original Republican Party, which became the Democratic Party, today's Democratic Party. But I don't think he was a particularly honest or good president in hindsight.
Those of you that are fans of John Adams, please disregard the comments that my co-host made and know that I don't share them. I'm joking. But moving on to the next two successors, and you have touched on it, you definitely see an acceleration in the openness or the willingness for violence on the part of the American government and, by extension, the American military. As it pertains to Madison, again, and we've often talked about this, you see this huge transformation from a father of the Constitution, one of the authors, really the principal author of the Federalist Paper, good friend of Alexander Hamilton, one of the pillars of the Federalist system, the Federalist Party, and then he becomes an ardent Jeffersonian almost overnight. When he is Secretary of State, and then when he is president, you do see this aggressiveness, correct? Where
yes.
He is, he's much more determined not only to expand slavery, but really push America to become the principal power of this hemisphere. And he does seem to be a little bit more combative with the European powers, it seems, whereas Jefferson and certainly Adams and Washington were much more akin to having a foreign policy that basically involved hiding under the covers and pretending that the rest of the world didn't exist.
And on that score, I would even, before I get into the specific belligerence with regards to Florida, I'd say the one time Jefferson didn't adhere to what you just said was with the Embargo Act, which I completely lay on the doorstep of Madison as Secretary of State and as the guy who advised Jefferson, you know what, this is how we deal with France and England and Great Britain. We don't trade with them, and we shutter our ports to them. Well, that sent the U.S. economy into a tailspin, and Jefferson and maybe Madison was smart in that he had crafted it so the thing sunsetted the day that he took office, but in March of 1809. But that was the reality. It was a horrible policy, and it was his policy, even though it was the Jefferson administration. Now, in terms of Florida, West Florida, there is a rebellion in 1810, and the Republic of West Florida is declared. Now, there was very clearly some tacit encouragement from the Madison administration and from agents of the U.S. government, including this very... I have no other term to use other than this scoundrel, General James Wilkinson, who was involved with Aaron Burr, had been a general in the Revolutionary War, but really not a distinguished military general. Jefferson, for some reason, trusted him. He was a double agent with Spain during part of this period. And then Wilkinson, of course, also then later serves in the War of 1812 and... is an embarrassment as a military commander. But Wilkinson was successful in ginning up a lot of sentiment against Spain in West Florida. And eventually there is a detachment of Baton Rouge where there are West Florida, the Republic of West Florida is declared and it's annexed by the U.S. in late 1810. And then there was a rebellion in Mobile. That is also then detached from Spanish West Florida and added to the annexed by the U.S. in 1813. Wilkinson is behind that. He is instrumental in that. But still, Pensacola at this point remains in Spanish hands, which is going to be critical when we talk about the British and Andrew Jackson in a few minutes. But at the same time, in 1811, and we have to thank the eminent historian of our time, one of the eminent historians of American history, Gary Wills, for uncovering this. He writes about Madison, and then I cite directly in my book, Madison commissioning agents to seize East Florida effectively from the Spanish, to mass on the Georgia-Florida border, to train militia, to build a force, and then take Fernandina Beach and Amelia Island by force. This ends up happening in early 1812, and Madison had put a couple of agents in charge of this who were disreputable folks, and it created an international incident. James Monroe, who by this time had become the Secretary of State, by the way, he was not Madison's original Secretary of State. I don't want to get into the history of the Madison administration, but Madison made a horrible decision, Secretary of State. He had originally wanted Gallatin, who of course was Jefferson's Treasury Secretary, and was, I guess, if you want to say there was a triumvirate that ran that anti-Federalist Party or Republican Party, whatever you want to call it, it was Jefferson, Madison, and Gallatin, right, from Pennsylvania. But the Senate's not going to approve him, so he puts another guy in, Smith, who is awful, right, terrible at the job. Finally, Monroe is there. But Monroe did not want to get into this confrontation with Spain at this point. They are readying for war with Britain, very unwisely, the United States. The British, as I talk about throughout my book, still have a lot of influence in Florida. It's a Spanish colony at this point. It's being governed by the Spanish. But the natives in Florida, whether they were Seminole, Miccosukee, or Creeks, had more of a relationship with the British. In fact, I write about the state of Muskogee, which was based in the town of Miccosukee, which is in Leon County, which is now in Leon County. That independent breakaway Native American state was effectively a British proxy, where you had British bureaucrats coming from the Bahamas, training the civil servants, and you had the British arming them. So, and we're going to get more into that when we get to Andrew Jackson, the British angle. But Madison effectively has to stand down when after Amelia Island and Fernandina Beach are captured, and the American flag is raised at the fort, and then these guys go dig deep, kind of penetrate deeper into Florida territory, and are just miles away from St. Augustine, and at the same time, the U.S. has unwisely declared war on Great Britain, who is an ally of Spain at this point. And in order to keep Spain out of the war on the British side, Monroe, you know, orders the U.S. regulars who are part of this. And by the way, there were U.S. regulars. It wasn't just this ragtag group that had been put together of Georgia militia and some volunteers from Florida that seized Amelia Island and Fernandina Beach and then moved their way down the St. John's River towards St. Augustine. There were some U.S. regulars. Monroe has to demand they stand down and return to Georgia. And so they retreat, and the ragtag group is left kind of abandoned and has to follow them. And they return Fernandina and Amelia Island to the Spanish. But the reality is Madison himself probably would have just let it go. I think Monroe had to force the issue. And Madison, at the same time, you know, aside from Florida, at this very same time, he's surrounding himself with some really bad people and making bad appointments in terms of this war against Great Britain, the War of 1812. So, yeah, my view of Madison has been colored by doing this research. I always had him on my list of people I admired. But I think he was a great thinker, maybe a great an unbelievable Enlightenment figure who was a horrible administrator and a very bad judge of character. And then I also think, to your point, just to finish up, he did want to expand slavery, which is another thing that I had not thought. I had always thought that the expansion, this mania among Southerners to expand slavery by taking Cuba and bleeding Kansas and all of that had come later. But I think Madison is the first guy who's seeing Florida being his aim. But then if he had come a generation later, would have seen Cuba or New Mexico as places to expand slavery. I think he's very much the first of that line. Remember, the cotton gin has been invented by this time. And you have a situation where the slave trade has been banned. So, Southerners are looking for places to expand also their market to sell their own slaves, right? And to breed slaves and sell them. So I think Madison very much was the founder in some ways of the slaveocracy, if you want to call it that. That's what Republican politicians in the 1850s, the likes of the Sewards and the Charles Sumners, called it a slaveocracy. Maybe Madison was the founder of that.
Now, jumping ahead a little bit, War of 1812 finally ends. You have a new administration, arguably the most effective U.S. president of the early 1800s, and who is arguably considered not the greatest Secretary of State. That's usually regarded, handed down to Lincoln, Secretary of State Stewart, but certainly the second greatest Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams. So you have these basically the MVPs of this era of American politics, and they decide that basically the American people aren't going to stomach a armed takeover of Florida. So they go to the treaty room. They do the whole diplomatic route. They fork over the cash to get it. Everything's going well, except there's a slight wrinkle in the ointment, and that is this emerging national figure, the hero of New Orleans that we've been alluding to, the first great shadow figure that looms over Florida history, Andrew Jackson.
Yeah, I would go take it a little further back into Madison's administration and the War of 1812. Jackson pursued the Red Sticks and the Creeks into Florida in 1814 and ended up taking Pensacola. Now, what had happened, I don't want to get, it's in the book. This is, I guess, a plug to read the book. I get through the whole kind of British occupation of Pensacola, even though it was Spanish territory, and eventually the Spanish aren't thrilled with the British occupation, but the British have the natives on their side. So the Spanish originally invite the British in because the British say, hey, we're trying to stop the U.S. from these sorts of operations that could impact you, which included New Orleans and also included the wars against the native peoples. But then the British take Pensacola. Jackson evicts them. But there is a conflict with the British going on, because the British obviously are at war with the United States, but also are very clearly arming the Seminole. The other thing the British are doing is that they are aiding runaway slaves. They are openly, the British forces in Georgia that are fighting, right? Remember, the U.S. has declared war on Britain. So we have to keep that in mind in all of this. Britain did not initially declare war on the United States. The United States, led by James Madison and led by Henry Clay in the Congress, declare war on Great Britain. And so the British are, and I write about this in the book, that the British, including George Cockburn, Admiral George Cockburn, who's the same man who burnt the White House down, are actively coming to South Georgia and North Florida and freeing slaves, burning plantations and telling the slaves, you know what, you're free. We'll take you, some of them. They took back to Canada. Others, they you know, said, hey, move into the hinterland with our allies, the Seminoles. So Jackson, being the being what he is, I mean, how blunt do we want to be? I guess we'll be blunt. Being the hater of Native Americans and the lover of slavery he is, and defender of the South that he is, although obviously the nullification crisis comes later, and some Southerners would say he wasn't such a defender of the South at that point. But nullification crisis comes when he's president. At this point, he is very much a Southerner first. He sees this as a threat. So he takes Pensacola. We talked about New Orleans. 1816, he orders two names that are famous in Florida, right? Gadsden and Gaines. Gaines Street is in Tallahassee. You work on Gaines Street, Robert. He orders Commander Gaines to take the Negro fort on the Apalachicola River. We've talked about this in a previous podcast. This is a fort where there are runaway slaves, hundreds of them, that had created their own kind of town of free African Americans. They are, in fact, at this point, flying the British flag on their fort because the British had left arms with them and many had served in the British military fighting against the United States. This is another thing I should have mentioned. As the British are freeing slaves, they're arming them. And they're putting them in the British military. They're giving some of them even command. Some of these guys had titles. Some of these guys were British officers. I think there were three or four former British officers who were former slaves that were at that fort. So long story short, we have another podcast where we talk about this battle that you and I recorded a while ago, Robert. But the U.S. destroys the fort. They kill hundreds of free African Americans. That should be that. Okay, that was something that Madison tolerated. Madison's still president at the time. I think Monroe has just become president at the time. But then what Monroe did not want was Jackson to go down to St. Mark's, right on the coast. It's now Wakulla County, right? But that area, and capture a couple of British officers and try them and hang them. British officers that were with the natives. He wouldn't want Jackson to be taking more native areas. That's when the Spanish protested, right? The Negro fort thing, they let happen. And at that point, you're looking at an international incident. The Spanish say to John Quincy Adams, you're trying to buy Florida from us. You've negotiated in bad faith as the Secretary of State because you've got an army that's invaded Florida. We're not talking to you anymore. And you and I have talked about this before. John C. Calhoun, who was the Secretary of War, goes crazy about this in the cabinet. Now, as it turns out, and I write about this in the book, Calhoun didn't have much support in the cabinet. Now, the cabinet didn't want to say, hey, we're with you, Jackson. We're going to force the Spanish out. President Monroe didn't want to say that. John Quincy Adams did say that. But they didn't want to go with Calhoun either on censuring Jackson. They didn't want to go with Calhoun either on removing Jackson. And that's very telling. See, the way I always understood the story, Robert, until I did more developed research on this, was that I thought, okay, Calhoun wanted Jackson removed and censured, and the rest of the cabinet was really angry. Monroe was really angry. And Adams saved him. Well, I think Adams saved him publicly, but privately none of them wanted. They realized the Spanish were put in an impossible position and would have to resume negotiations, which they did, and then have to sell Florida, which they did. And Monroe could count that as a victory. Last point on Monroe, and maybe last point before we wrap up this discussion. The Monroe Doctrine comes in 1823. Based on what my research, a lot of it involving Florida and the British influence in Florida, including the liberating of slaves that we talked about earlier, and then this saltwater railroad that operated through Cape Florida to the Bahamas, which is a British possession. My interpretation of the Monroe Doctrine now is it may have been a way of telling the British and the Spanish and the French, don't mess with our slavery. Because attitudes about slavery, as I write about in the book, had changed dramatically in the British Empire between 1800 and 1820. To the point where by about 1820, the British are looking at the Americans, and particularly Southerners, as barbarians, because they have this institution, even though it was the British themselves who brought the institution to the America, to North America. But attitudes in Britain, just, and it's imaginable, because think about in contemporary Robert, the cultural attitudes in 2004 were, in this state, we voted to ban gay marriage. By 2015, you couldn't find anyone who was against gay marriage in the state, with the exception of some Republican politicians. Cultural attitudes sometimes change quickly, and it did in the British Empire, to the point what by 1820, the British Empire is steadfastly against slavery. They're going to ban slavery outright in the 1830s, but by 1825, they're telling runaway slaves who are making their way through Florida to the Bahamas and to Jamaica, hey, we're not going to re-enslave you if you come to the Bahamas. We're not going to return you to your masters if you come to the Bahamas. You're going to be free. You're going to be like any other citizen. We're just going to turn a blind eye and you go get a job or whatever. So my final premise was that some of the Monroe Doctrine was based on a desire to protect slavery, coming from Monroe, who, of course, himself was a slaveholder and represented, at that point, what was a Southern party. I don't want that to diminish Monroe too much, because I still would put him in the top five or top 10 presidents, which I would not put Madison in, as you heard earlier. I do think Monroe was one of our best presidents, one of our best Secretary of State, one of our great heroes in American history, right? He crossed the Delaware with Washington. People forget that because he was a junior soldier. But this might have been a flaw in his character, the whole slavery thing, the way we look at it from today's perspective. Now, at the same time, I think there was the belligerence about how you treat slaves came later. And I think you're going to see that start with Calhoun. Really, and with some of the fire eaters further down the road. I think Monroe was part of the African Colonization Society, which is not something I would agree with, but I certainly think he had, at least in his mind, a more enlightened view of slavery than some of the other Southerners. I don't consider any of it enlightened personally, but that's me sitting 200 years later judging it, as we are 201 years from... we're 200 years from the election of 1824, which was a lot of it was about the way Jackson had taken Florida, even though, there was a situation here where Adams had backed him and Adams was his primary opponent. Last point I want to make on this. Henry Clay, of course, was a leader in Congress during this period. Clay wants to not only investigate Jackson for the invasion of Florida, he wants to investigate Jackson for the hanging of the British officers that I write about in the book. And Clay, the dislike Clay has for Andrew Jackson, I believe, starts with the Florida episode. It didn't just come from 1824 onward. It didn't just come from what Jackson called the corrupt bargain with Adams. I think Clay has a very bad opinion of General Jackson from 1817 and 1818 onwards. So there's a lot of criticism of Clay as a guy that didn't, that just tweaked his own political philosophy to be anti-Jacksonian. I don't believe that. Actually, Clay's one of the guys I admire in early American history. I think he had a clear philosophy for the economic development of this country that most of these other guys didn't have. And I do now have found that he, as the Speaker of the House, was really offended by Jackson, even in this period.
So this is your third book in this series.
Yes.
Covering this this really extraordinary and difficult birth of the Sunshine State. And all the national and international politics and warfare that have gone into that period. where are we going to go from here? Is this the conclusion? Is it a trilogy of books? Or are we going to see anything further down the pipeline? Are you going to be going into something dealing with statehood? Where are you going from here?
Well, this was intended to be a trilogy, so this is the end of the trilogy. I had intended to take it until the Florida Territory was born. I'm now hedging on that because I do think maybe I need to take it through statehood or through secession. So this particular series is over, but the next thing I write might be about 1820 to 1860, or maybe we go to 1845. Maybe we split it up that way. There's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about the development of Florida from that period. And then the other thing I really want to look at as we go forward is potentially the popularity and the sort of origins of populism in Florida. So that's something I might do completely separately, and that would start with the 1890s, really. So it's a completely different generation, and I would like to take that through Claude Pepper and into you could say in a way Charlie Crist was a populist, right? Never mind what happened to him the last time he ran for governor. That was more a reaction to the times, but you could say Crist was a populist, which is why the one-time Republican becomes a Democrat. And I think certainly you have elements of populism even with Askew and Graham and with Collins. So and certainly with Pepper and with Smathers, less so with Spencer Holland, less so with, and Lawton Childs was kind of a populist, actually. So
certainly,
yeah. So that's something I'm looking at in the future, but that would be after I'm debating, and I'm probably going to take some time over this. I feel like I should take us through either statehood or the Civil War, because we've gone this far, and I had intended to leave it off in 1821 or basically 1825, which is when I end the book talking about the building of the Cape Florida Lighthouse, which was built so that they could escape slaves. Runaway slaves were escaping to the Bahamas through Key Biscayne. So that light was built at that point at the end of the Monroe administration, commissioned at the end of the Monroe administration. It was first lit during the John Quincy Adams administration. And that's where I leave off saying, okay, Florida's now a territory. It's like any other southern slave area. And the point of this trilogy was to show Florida was different in its origins than the rest of the South. But now I'm thinking maybe I need to go through statehood. So stay tuned.
Fantastic. And for our devotees that listen to this podcast, as you guys are aware, this podcast is an offshoot of the wonderful and nationally well-known Florida Squeeze, the blog that you, good sir, have been running now for, I think you're approaching your second decade, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep, we are into our second decade, thankfully.
And there's also a YouTube channel that is very well regarded, and we've done you and me have done a number of streaming documentaries, and this book is part of the latest release of what is our little modest publishing house that Florida Squeeze operates, and we look forward to you guys enjoying this wonderful book and continuing this journey that we've been going on now for about 5 years to bring you as much Florida history as concise and as breezy and as friendly as we know how.
And before we let off, Robert, I want to ask you, what's next? You're working on the next book or two in the Florida Squeeze publishing house series.
Yes, we were very excited because we have Lincoln's Ghost coming out next month, which is it's the complete almost 200-year history of presidential ghost stories and myths. And we just got the artwork in today from a great local artist, and Very excited about it. That is the next release from our publishing house. Unless you sneak another book in on me while I'm not looking, you're definitely making me look bad. You're becoming very prolific with your books lately. And then after that, probably gonna round up my trilogy of old Florida, my old Florida series, with a look at piracy in the state of Florida.
And the piracy thing is going to be particularly exciting, I think, for not to diminish Lincoln's ghost, but the piracy thing is going to be particularly exciting because I see more and more discussion of Florida's role in the entire kind of Pirates of the Caribbean, Pirates of the Atlantic theme, which to me is an untold story. So can't wait for that. And I think that that's such an important part of Florida history that I actually regret in this trilogy. I touched on it, and there's some pieces that are about, in the first book in particular, that have piracy angle, but I think maybe I should have dove deeper into it in my own writing. So really excited about this book.
Well, I'm probably going to ask you to write the foreword. So
there you go.
And there are elements of your book series that I have in the appendices. And an example of, you know, just really shameless cross promotion. But yeah, it's definitely very interesting. And, when that's done, we're probably going to go after, the Golden Age, cause, we got a lot of love for that era, and we have a lot of anecdotes. And unlike all the other subjects we've talked about, we actually knew all of the figures of that era. And so there's hours and hours of interviews and recordings and stuff that we have for that. And that might end up being its own trilogy, covering the 60s and the 70s and the 80s of Florida state government.
Yeah, in fact, I think the first time you and I know we were in the same building at the same place was at Governor Askew's Memorial Service. So now going on 10 years, it's been almost exactly 10 years. It was February or March of 2014. So thank you, Robert, for that. And we will be back next week with another Florida History Podcast.